topics that we said that touch upon the whole theme of Sukkos that emerged from the first Mishnah is the question of tzel. So just to recap, there are three possible explanations of why it is that a sukkah can't be too high, and all of them draw upon broad sukkah issues. So the two that we've discussed already is the question of awareness, that maybe if schach is too high, we don't know what's flying, I guess semi-literally, and we don't have an awareness of sukkah, and that's important because of l'man yedu dor haseichem, and we talked about how that's been taken in further directions by the Bach and others. And then the question of diras arai, diras kava, clearly also very central to the identity of a sukkah, and that might be affected by having a sukkah that is too high. So now the third issue that emerges from this discussion is the question of the influence of the schach itself. And the Mishnah tells us that you can't have a sukkah that is chamtzeru miselsa, that the schach has to dominate, and the tzel of the schach has to dominate. And there is a lot of discussion about Rashi related to this. What does Rashi say? That when the Gemara says, dal dufonos leka tzel sukkah, that if you take away the... Actually, there's a couple of Rashis that are relevant here. This Rashi also makes the point, but we're really focusing on an earlier Rashi. Where'd it go? Here, sorry, the Rashi on the Mishnah, Shecham Sarav Mitzelza, Hamiyut Batl Berov. That if you're going to have too much sunlight, so the minority of the schach will be batul berov, v'harehu kimi she'eino, v'al shem haschach kari soga. So this Rashi attracted a lot of attention. And one issue is the way the Ran not so much argues on Rashi, but seems to redefine what Rashi is saying. That Rashi sounds like he's saying that the schach is batul. And the Ran emphasizes that it's not the schach that we're talking about, but rather it is the impact of the schach, the tzel. The tzel is batel by the light. And that it sounds like that from Gemaras that talk about such a thing, the Gemara later on, that talks about a sukkah that's 50-50, and ultimately what emerges is that we're talking about 50-50 on the bottom, not 50-50 on the top. We're talking about the impact of the schach and the tzel. So there is a discussion as to what the issue is, right? What seems to be the concern with Rashi as literally read? Yes, Jacob?
Does it make sense for something to be butt out of the snicker?
Okay, so that seems to be the problem. The question of, can you have bittul in such a circumstance? That here you have a physical, identifiable physical item, so can you apply the terminology of bittul here? And in fact, the Gemara seems to already address this when the Gemara talks about you have schach pasul coming from a tree on top of your schach, and you can make a kasher by mixing it in, by taking in and mixing it in with the schach itself. And there the emphasis seems to be that the reason that works is because it's not nicker anymore, because you can't identify within that the pasul schach. So to say that item like the entirety of the schach is going to be negated by the sunlight is a difficult position to take. And therefore, perhaps what we mean is not the schach, but the effect of the schach, the shade downstairs, the shade on the floor. And we discussed also how... Yes, sir?
Is the shade versus the sun something that's not bigger?
Yeah, because here we're talking about ephemeral items. You know, we're talking about something that's... assume that that's what's driving it, that we're not talking about an actual physical object that you can hold in your hand. We're talking about something that I think there's probably got to be some poetic image for this, because it sounds like something that's very ephemeral, and it's got to be the right word that's going to describe just how intangible shade is. But essentially that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about a physical object that's actually going to be identifiable. Right, because it's a moving target, you know, and it's I assume that's what he means. So, and that the influence, and that they ultimately merge together. Right? So they ultimately create one entity. So part of the discussion has to do with the distinction between bittul birov, which is Rashi's language here, and really something that would be more appropriately called rubo kikulo. That are we talking about that something is negated? Like, is this comparable to when you have two dayanim voting against one dayan in Bevesdin with three people on it? So the two went out over the one. So what does that mean? So Tosfos in Sanhedrin has the language that in that case the miyut is kishe'eno. And Reb Chaim Brisker has a discussion about this, a brief discussion that's printed in the stencils, that goes to the question of what do we mean when we talk about this bittul is mishe'eno. And just to explain, I don't remember in how much detail we explained this the first time, but maybe we'll just try to make sure this point is clear. That Tosfos comes up in the context of Ein Holchin B'Momen Acher HaRov. So just to explain that, so again, a little bit more detail maybe than we did the first time, that we normally have a principle that in monetary issues, we do not allow the majority to take over. So what does that normally mean? Because there are some contradictory impressions. So the Gemara says that essentially, that if you and I are having a monetary fight, and I say I'm right because in most cases, let's say you're the muchzak, right? And I say in most cases the facts would be like I am advocating. So chances are I'm right because 75% of all situations are like me. So therefore the odds are I'm the one who's correct here. And Jebediah only has 25% of the chances. So nonetheless, he wins. Because he's the muchzak, he's holding on to the money. And my robe is not going to change that. You follow? Right. So normally the muchzak always has the upper hand. And even if I come and say 75% of all cases, 80% of all cases, 90% of all cases, the facts are like me, so it's overwhelmingly likely that I'm right. Still, Jed gets to hold on to his money. So some of the Rishonim discuss, well, we don't always follow this idea because we do rely on rov sometimes in monetary matters. And in more than monetary matters, in life and death matters, we rely on rov. So, for example, if you go to a Beis Din, you go to a Beis Din and you have two dayanim voting one way and one voting the other, so we follow the rov. So there, it's going to affect money. So if two dayanim say that I'm right and Jed is wrong, so Jed's going to have to reach into his pocket and give me money. It's going to be motzim and a mochzak based on a rov. So how come a minute ago we said that I come with a 75-80% rov doesn't help? Ein holchem mamon acher rov. But we know that we do follow a rov dayanim to get the same impact. Now you follow the question? So some of the Rishonim explain that they're not comparable. That when you're dealing with the statistics, they say 80% of the cases are on my side. So that's not a slam dunk, because there are some cases that are not on my side. 20% of the cases are on my side. So when Jed says, listen, I disagree with you, so he's a muchzak, so already that gives him the upper hand. If he has no claim whatsoever because there's a 0% chance that he has a legitimate hold on that money, then okay, all right, it's funny that he's a muchzak, but still, I'm right because I'm 100% right. But if he's anything on his side at all, 20% chance on his side, so then it could be that he's right. 20% of the circumstances, he's right. And he has the chazakah, he's holding on to. So the Rishonim have the language, smoch miyuto l'chazaka. What does that mean? It means that the miyut, this 20%, which you think, what's good as a miyut? A miyut is the losing hand, right? What good is a miyut? So what they seem to be saying is that the value of a miyut means that it's possible that he's right, that there are situations in which he's right. So you take that together with the fact that he's holding on to the money, that's enough to allow him to keep holding on to it. And my rov, just because I'm usually right, the facts are usually on my side, but I'm not objectively 100% right, and that's not enough to take money away from a mukhsak. Right.
Can't the mukhsak always create some sort of claim, even if it's a ridiculous claim, that still makes it like a 1% chance that he might be right, even though 99.99% would look like it's the money really doesn't belong to him? He could still make some ridiculous case that would make it.
So it's an interesting question. There's a little subjectivity here. First of all, it's not necessarily based on his claim. You know, so it's not just based on what he's saying. The question is, if I'm coming at you specifically with some kind of a rove claim, so then that rove claim is not going to do it because you can come at me with a mirror claim. But there are other claims I might make which are not necessarily based on rove, and therefore your response is not necessarily going to beat me that way. But again, you do have the upper hand because of the chazaka. So it is true that a lot of the circumstances will make it harder. I have to have a pretty strong case in order to take money away from you. So the premise is somewhat true. But at the same time, this is not going to affect all back and forths between litigants. It's just, if I'm coming at you with a rove, your response will be that, okay, it's very nice to have a rove, but a rove is not absolute. We have minority rights, right? There's such a thing as a minority. So why should my minority position be labeled as impossible just because rove cases are not like that? Rove is helpful when you don't have a chazaka, when you don't have a way to know one way or another, right? A chazaka is a presumption that things are in a certain way. So when you don't have a chazaka, okay, so then things could go either way, so they're more likely like the rove. I don't have a way to know whether it's A or B. There's no logic for me to say A or B. So then I'll follow the one that's more likely. But when I have a chazaka, the presumption is that the chazaka is right. We say a chazaka that whatever is tachas yado shalom reyu shalom, that the presumption is if you have something, it's probably yours. Now, it doesn't have to be yours. It's possible that you stole it. It's possible that you borrowed it. But the most likely presumption is that what is in your possession is likely yours. So then that's where we start from. And I have to take it away from you only through a really strong proof. Now, some of the achronim really distinguish between different levels of rove, that maybe a really strong rove might perhaps be able to have a greater impact on your chazaka, and that maybe when the Gemara invokes it, it doesn't mean it as an absolute. It means it as a contextual point, that this rove, whatever rove the Gemara is talking about on that daf, is not strong enough. Not that never holchem aman achar rove, that really in the places where it appears, it should be read as ain holchem aman achar this rove. This rove is not strong enough. Why are we talking about it? This is all really tangential. It'll be fascinating stuff. But this is tangential just to contrast it with the other possibility. So the other possibility is, what about the dayanim? So the dayanim, we follow a rove. So Chaim explains that no, it's different than the case we were talking about a minute ago. A minute ago, Jed has the minority to hold on to. The existence of the minority is important because it shows that his position is plausible. So together with the chazaka and a plausible possibility, so he wins. Doesn't have to be the most likely possibility, it has to be one of the possibilities. So that minority is something that he can hold on to. But, says Tosfos, and here's where it's going to tie back into what we're talking about here, that when it comes to Dayanim, there is no minority. Why? What do you mean there's no minority? What about the one vote who went the other direction? It's bottle. That essentially a Bezdin issues a psak, and that psak comes from the entire Bezdin. The entire Bezdin, even though it has mixed opinions within its voice, within its composition, once they vote, so the majority defines the Bezdin's position, and that is the Bezdin's position. So there is no more minority. Sorry? Right, but it's irrelevant halachically because now the Bezdin is a joint entity. Just by the way, again, it's tangential if you're curious about this. This has implications for how halacha is passed in general. because the fact that we follow the rov, it's got to be defined first. What do you mean by rov in Psak? Do you mean rov like just counting up all of the views that ever existed in history and trying to figure out what is the majority view, which has a certain place in halachic discussion? Or are we specifically talking about when there are b'moshe v'echad, when you have a bezdin context, you have a bezdin agadol, you have a session where everybody is together as one entity and they vote formally, and then that defines the position? That's a different kind of rov, even in the terms of determining halacha. So here, essentially, what we're talking about with the bezdin is that the bezdin becomes defined by the rov. Hi.
Where should we look to learn more about that?
I'm happy to talk about it on a day that's off of it's a Sanhedrin topic. So if you go back in history, it's when we're saying Shema Sanhedrin, that was a few years ago. There definitely it's on Yud Torah, but happy to make it a one of the question day topics. There's a lot of discussion about that. You know what exactly? It's a fascinating topic to pursue. You know, Chumash Menachah Rov is a great sugya. There's a lot to talk about, but here all of this is just tangential, really, just to explain what we're talking about, what we're contrasting it with, that the idea that the Rov takes over the whole entity. So some Achronim on our daf, talking about Sukkah, suggests that that's a better model here, that we're not saying that we're trying to be Mevatel the Schach. Even though Rashi's language sounds like it. But we're saying more that we need to define the sukkah. Is the sukkah a kosher sukkah or not? And what it needs to be kosher, is it shaded or is it not shaded? So it's going to be defined by its majority. So if it's mostly sunny, so then that's going to be a problem. If it's mostly shaded, so then that's called a sukkah. So we mentioned about Shlomo Warman's Chana Levracha talks about this in his Sefer. By Warman's Sfarim are all available now on HebrewBooks.org. You can read them online. So he makes that point, essentially, that he thinks what Rashi is getting at is that we are coming to define the entity of the sukkah rather than talking about, like in the kashrus setting of something, of some milchiks falling into your fleshiks and getting bottle, but rather we're talking about defining the whole identity of the sukkah. And to that, he addresses a question that the Pnei Yeshua asks. He says, why don't we say, if we're going to have this bittul like Rashi is suggesting, so don't we have a similar reality if you have the walls of a sukkah, that they don't necessarily take up the majority of the space, so as we discuss later on, so why don't we say the walls are bottle? So the response would be that we're not talking about the physical elements of the sukkah being batal. We're talking about defining the sukkah as either shaded or not shaded. And that's where rov is going to come and to play a determinant role. And then when we finished off this topic, so we spoke about the question of why the tzel is so important. And we mentioned one hashkafic idea that I recently seen in the Sefer, that tzel is representative of the whole dichotomy between Olam Hazeh and Haba, because it creates something through the absence of something. It interrupts the light and therefore creates a impact, but it's really the false impact, because the real impact is really the light. So it shows the difference between Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. But presumably more to the point, the idea is that the sail is the sukkah, that we have this dominant imagery of the schach as representing the whole sukkah, and the schach is there to provide shade. So if we're not getting shade from the schach, so then we're not looking here at an actual sukkah, we're looking at something that is not defined as a sukkah, and that's what Rashi writes here also, Bat al Shem Haschach Kari Sukkah. Okay, any questions about any of that? Any issues? Alright, so we have a few more minutes. Should we go on to the next topic, or does anyone have a question about any other topic?
Yes. Definitely not Rashi's Lashon.
Yeah, the language is not perfect fit.
Because then the whole point is we're not saying, but that there's a
rove. Right, we're not saying that the rove knocks out something in a bittul sense. Yeah, I think that's not a perfect fit in the language of Rashi. Rashi's language, if you look at it again, that harei kamisha eino, so that it sounds like he's saying that the schach is indeed nullified. So that's where the Ran seems to need to redefine what he's saying, that it's not so much that the schach itself is eino, but it's that the shade is ke'eino, and if the shade is ke'eino, then the sukkah is not a sukkah, and sukkah has to be defined by the presence of schach.
Ibrahim? And the problem of saying batal would be that we don't have this concept of saying batal when there's
a physical item. Yeah. Which is, yeah.
Let me see that by Yirnidacha.
So we said we define Yirnidacha as based on the Rov.
No, but yeah. I'm saying like when, I forgot the phrase, but like it says like when you have some from the Yirnidacha, like it's not existent.
Kutute Mechta Shire. Yeah, that's a different concept. The idea of Kutute Mechta Shire, which comes up a lot in Sukkah, and did we mention it actually maybe came up even this year already? It's going to come up in the context of lulav for sure. Did we? Oh, I tell you, right. We did talk about it in terms of the walls. That there, that's not a concept of bittul. What it means, that's a concept of an extension of a notion called omed. That kol ha-omed leblank is kablank dami. That whatever is waiting for a certain thing to happen has that status already. So when you say if something's here in Idachas, it's meant to be destroyed. So we say that, because it's on death row, it's ki'ilu, it doesn't exist. And that's called ketute mechta shiri. We say that the shir isn't there. I think we did talk about that in one context because it has to do with the walls. The question of whether you can have walls of Avodah Zarah, because if the walls are just there to serve a functional purpose, so then that's one thing. But if they're there to serve a conceptual purpose of chashivas, so that's when we sometimes invoke this concept, and that's how Reb Chaim explains the distinction. That the phrase ketutach ketutei mechta shiure sounds like it means that there isn't enough of the shiur isn't there. And Reb Chaim explains, it doesn't mean the shiur literally isn't there, because clearly the item is still there. It means that when the shiur is there for purposes of chashivas, is there to convey a certain importance, so then it doesn't have that importance if it's going to be destroyed. But if it's there to serve a functional purpose, then it could still serve a functional purpose. So when it comes to the walls of a sukkah, we're going to have to determine what are the walls there for, and that question is going to impact that. Okay. Any other questions, issues? Okay, does it make sense to start the next topic? Does it make sense to, what's the shortest thing we could do? So what's next? If we're going in order, what's next? Sorry? Yeah, that's what's next. So should we start that for just a few minutes? Okay, so let's start that. So this is going to get us into the basic requirements of a sukkah. And we're going to also end up talking about the halacha l'moshe misinais, about the various tools that we have that allow us to make space into physical territory, that where essentially there are gaps in the sukkah, but the halacha allows us to consider them to be actually filled in. And I don't know if we mentioned this the first time around, but Rav Schechter talks about a little bit the history behind that. That he mentioned that there was a professor at the JTS actually who had made a comment. Did we say this the first time around?
Yeah.
That when the rabbis of the Talmud talked about these halacha l'moshe misinai devices, that it was because there was a shortage of wood in the time of the Tanaim and Amoraim, and therefore there was a need to find ways to construct sukkahs without actually using so much wood. And Rav Soloveitchik responded to that by saying, it's not a terrible thing to say on the surface. It's not a completely impossible statement to say that Chazal, in invoking these halacha l'moshe misinai, were motivated by a situation such as a wood shortage. But that's not the whole explanation. That just shows you why they would recommend using these things. But the existence of these principles had to be there already. It has to be the halacha l'moshe misinai was already there, and because of perhaps something like a wood shortage, so then the rabbis would say, here you should avail yourself of this. And he made the comparison. It's like saying, how did the Americans in World War II, how did they develop an atom bomb? And the answer is, well, the Germans were going to do it first, so they developed an atom bomb. That doesn't explain the physics. That explains that because there was the war going on and the Germans were doing it first, so then they had to beat them to the punch. But you still have to...
That answers the why.
Right, essentially. How. Right, that's basically the point, right? So it's not going to tell us how it works. So too, there might be truth to the statement, which I have to say in the name of the Rav, that the pressure to utilize the Halacha L'Moshe Mitzrayim is because of a shortage of wood, but it's only possible to do that because the concept exists in and of itself. So we have a Masorah that there are these tools, so we have to figure out exactly what they mean, and maybe we'll use this time just to say what some of them are. So we have a concept of Labud. Labud means that when things are less than 3 tefachim apart from each other, we can consider them as if they are filled in. We have a concept of Dofen Akuma. Dofen Akuma is a fascinating idea just for what it says about, apparently, about architecture of those times, that it may mean that if you have a wall and then you have, let's say, you have schach on top, but the schach, some of the schach that's on the edge is not kosher schach. So under some circumstances, we could say that it's okay, depending on all the measurements and the placement and other issues, that it's okay to have a certain amount of non-kosher schach because the schach can be considered an extension of the wall. And that's what we call a dofen akuma, that the wall is curved. So let's say over here, if you only had kosher schach over here and not over there where the ridge is, let's say that that's non-kosher schach. So that theoretically could be okay because we'll pretend that this, or we'll consider it that this is all a wall and the wall bends to the top and the ceiling just starts in the middle. And Rashi explains that, yeah, just like some walls, the walls sometimes curve to the top. So nowadays, I don't know how often we see walls that curve like that. Maybe that was a feature of their architecture, but that, since it's apparently conceivable that a wall could look like that, so we have the right to envision our sukkah in such a fashion. And then, what's disputed, and this is going to be a topic I guess we'll get into hopefully tomorrow after establishing this issue of the count of the walls, is the question of whether in sukkah we have a concept of good asik and good achis mechitza. That we have a mechitza, and the mechitza only covers a certain amount of territory. So are we able to consider it as if it goes all the way up, so we call it good asik, or consider it that it goes all the way down, that's called good achis. So as we'll see, it's a little bit of a machlokas whether that exists within sukkah or not, and what role it plays. But first, what's going to come up, I guess we'll discuss this tomorrow, is the question of what counts as a wall. That we have a discussion of how many walls that we need. This is something that the Mishnah already talks about. The Mishnah says at the end, "V'she'ein lo shlosha defanos," that's included in what is psula. So the question is going to become, what constitutes at least the third wall? And we're going to find that there is a possibility of having a wall that is a tefach, and we're going to have to try to figure out, is that tefach mean that that itself is the whole wall? Does it mean that somehow it creates a space that counts as a wall even beyond itself? All of that is going to be included in that discussion. Okay, so far so good. Everybody on track? All right, so hopefully let's try then, unless we have a different plan by tomorrow, let's try to address all of these Halacha L'Moshe Mitzrayim issues tomorrow, and that will give us Sunday for the Rabbanon issues to go over that. Okay, so we should have one wonderful day. Should be only good things. Yeah,